goes with the territory. So everybody's going to know about nuclear fusion. And the exciting thing was, if you use the right stuff in the right way, and there's no point in doing it if you don't, then you can kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. So it's a good illustration of Friedman's law that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. And it's one of the things that I bring to the subject, four special things about my sort of weird background. One of the biggest objections is you can't get here from there. I've worked on fission and fusion propulsion systems. You can get here from there, not on a bicycle. I just look back 100 years, and in many of my lectures, I usually speak on flying saucers are real, more than 600 colleges, 100 professional groups, all 50 states, 9 provinces, and 16 other countries. So I get around. I've only had 11 hecklers, incidentally, and two of them were drunk. And you're going to have that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, or whatever. But the biggest objection, you can't get here from there. I'm qualified to talk about that, and you can get here from there. Now, I should stress, I'm only interested in a local neighborhood. I get people saying, well, look how much energy it would take to get to another galaxy. I couldn't care less. Within 55 light years, there's fewer than 2,000 stars. There's about 46 that are similar to the sun and might be expected to have planets and life and so forth. That's enough room for me to worry about. The next big galaxy over is 2 million light years away. The stars I think some of these guys come from, guys or gals, I don't know which, obviously, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, it's a constellation of Reticulum, got to go down the equator to see them, close to it anyway. These two stars are only 39 light years away. But look how different their perspective is. These two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart. They're 35 times closer to each other than our star, the sun, is to the next star over. 35 times closer. And from a planet around one, looking over at the other, you see it all day long. There would be far more incentive for interstellar travel when you got a next-door neighbor, as they do. And, oh, incidentally, these two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. Which one? It would give them enough time to develop some technology about which we know nothing. Our egos get in the way. Every generation thinks it knows all there is to know, and it turns out the next generation comes along and proves them wrong. It's an important point because people look back instead of looking forward. Look back 105 years before man's first flight. A great astronomer proved that the only way man would ever fly would be with the help of a balloon. He didn't know anything about flight. 1926, another great astronomer gave a talk to the British Association for the Advancement of Science, in which he proved would be impossible to put anything into orbit around the Earth. And my favorite, because I'm a dual citizen of Canada and the United States, a Canadian astronomer, Dr. Campbell, 1941, showed that the required initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon back, just a dumb old chemical rocket, would be a million tons. Now, you fast forward 30 years, less than 30 years, and you find that we got three guys to the moon and back, still with a dumb old chemical rocket, whose initial launch weight was 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. He was astronomically in error. And I bring this up because I get sick and tired of people telling me, and I was in a little discussion on the Internet just yesterday about this, that you can't get here from there. It would take too much energy. Well, how much energy anything takes to get accomplished depends on the technique for doing it. The guy who was so wrong about going to the moon assumed a single-stage rocket, limited to 1G acceleration, using a retro rocket to slow down and having to provide all the energy. Well, all of those are nonsensical. We use multi-stage rockets. We have up to 5 or 6 Gs instead of 1 G limit. We use the atmosphere to slow us down instead of carrying along propellant, which we throw away, on and on. So if you make enough stupid assumptions, of course everything is impossible. You can't get from where I live in Fredericton, New Brunswick, to Los Angeles in a day on a bicycle. But I did it to do the Larry King show in much less than a day, but I didn't pedal. I flew. So that's one thing I bring, my background in advanced technology. Second, I worked under security for 14 years. And another one of the objections is governments can't keep secrets. Well, that's more hogwash. You don't keep secrets by telling everybody. Look, the Naval Research Lab had 12 unsuccessful failures of their Corona spy satellite before they got one that worked. When it finally worked, that one, it got more data about Soviet military sites, locations where they had rockets and airplanes and radar and all the rest of that, than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. That was in 1960. The first public discussion of the Corona spy satellite was 1995, 35 years later, and millions, billions of dollars were spent on that system. The NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, whose very existence was classified for 20 years, admitted in 2005 that, oh, by the way, we launched 7 Poppy satellites that were monitoring Soviet ships at sea and their electronics and so forth between 1962 and 1971. First public discussion, 2005. In 2001, the United States government finally admitted that 166 crewmen of American reconnaissance aircraft, which were tickling was the phrase that is used, the radar and other systems in North Korea, China, and Russia, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, had been shot down, died. All their families were lied to. They finally found out what had happened to their husbands, brothers, sons, whatever, in many cases 50 years earlier, in 2001, when the people were called together and they were given medals for their heroism of their family member. Can't keep secrets? Nonsense. Only people who haven't helped keep secrets would say that. And I've been to 20 archives, incidentally, and there's still, well, the Eisenhower Library. I went out of office in 1961. They still have 300,000 pages of classified material. Can't keep secrets? Nonsense. The third thing I bring, I guess, is that I have had to answer lots of questions about flying saucers. In the course of those more than 700 lectures and hundreds of radio and television programs and classroom visits and all the rest of it, I figure at least 40,000 questions. I mean, same questions over and over again, but still. So I've had to think about the answers to the why questions. I present lots of data at the beginning of my lecture. I find that fewer than 2% of the people in the audience have read any of the 5 major large-scale scientific studies that I discuss. That keeps them from asking me nasty questions when they have to admit they haven't read the stuff. I'm sneaky. But what they really want to know is the answer to the why questions. You know, why would aliens come here? Why would the government not tell us what's going on? Why don't they land on the White House lawn, et cetera, et cetera? So because I've been forced to think about these things, they seem to be interested in my answers. And finally, the fourth thing I bring is I'm a true Leo, born July 29th, same day as Peter Jennings, same day as Benito Mussolini, different years, of course. I enjoy being on the stage, so I'm comfortable with audiences. I try to share what information I have. So I come to this from a different viewpoint than most people do. And I enjoy the fact that people want to know more. That's what this is all about. And that's why I've written some books. And I've been involved in some things. I'm so old that I've been at this longer than most people. Gave my first lecture 40 years ago, mind you. that seems like a very long time ago. I've had a chance to talk to people all over the world, been very fortunate, and find that they are interested, they are willing to listen, but I have led the pack, if you will. I'm the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, starting way back in the 70s. No, I was not there in 1947, but I was the first to talk to Major Marcel. I've written the foreword to his son, Jesse Marcel Jr.'s brand new book, Legacy of Roswell. I've co-authored Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident, given papers at the Mutual UFO Network Symposia more than anybody, and I'll be speaking at this year's in Denver in early August, the 10th, 11th, 12th, 60 years since Roswell. I also was the first to publish about the Betty and Barney Hill star map, the most famous abduction on record, Betty and Barney Hill, the book The Interrupted Journey, 1966. Case took place in New Hampshire. Betty, under hypnosis, describes a star map, and there's a woman who built three-dimensional models, 26 of them, to try to figure out if the map made any sense. I was the first to publish about her work. And we've gone over all this in a brand new book, which I'm very proud of. I didn't do all the work, though. Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. My co-author is Kathleen Martin, who just happens to be Betty's niece. And she has all the tapes. She's transcribed the tapes, has all the correspondence. She was the executrix of Betty's estate. Betty died in 2004. And so we go over a lot of stuff that isn't in the first book. How much can you put in? And the star map work and the attacks on the star map work and the attacks of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I like to call them when I'm being polite. I can think of stronger words, but I won't use them here. People, I think, will find that an eye-opener because there's a lot they don't know. Even though there was a television movie, The Interrupted Journey, I mean, was the book, but the movie was The UFO Incident, NBC, Universal Studios, back in 1975. James Earl Jones played Barney. I was a consultant, and I still get a laugh out of the fact that Universal called the Air Force to find any scientists in the local area. This is in Southern California at the time. And they got my name from the Air Force. I haven't said a lot of good things about the Air Force and UFOs over the years. One of my papers on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, is Government UFO Lies. And I don't discriminate. I show lies from the Air Force, from the CIA, from the NSA, from the FBI, NRO. We don't discriminate at all. But anyway, the Air Force gave my name to the producers at Universal Studio, and they made that movie, The Interrupted Journey, and the book movie of the book. Actually, James Earl Jones owned the movie rights. It's about time to put out a DVD, James, if you're listening.
Listen, we need to take a short break.
Okay.
And we'll be right back. But I do want to mention, incidentally, and get pencil and paper if you don't want to have one handy, www.stantonfriedman.com is the website, and you're going to want to go up and check this website out. There's a lot of real interesting stuff up there, books, CDs, and there's material online you could read, all very interesting. Stantonfriedman.com. We'll be back right after this. If you would like to ask Stanton Friedman a question, be sure and send it to comment at kaij.us. That's comment at kaij.us. We'll be having Stanton back on the program, and at that time, he'll answer your questions. We're back, and our guest is Stanton Friedman. And you were talking about the Benny and Barney Hill incident. You were talking about the rights to the movie. But that star map, now, weren't we able to, or weren't you able to discern, tell us about the star map. I mean, this was supposed to be where these folks were from.
Well, they were called the Bay Stars. They'd finished their examination of Betty on board the UFO in Lincoln, New Hampshire. Barney was in another room. Interracial marriage, which is why Barney was played by James Earl Jones. Betty was played by Estelle Parsons. First time, believe it or not, a black man and a white woman in bed together on television. Believe me, that shows you how times have changed, is what I mean. But anyway, Betty...
Well, a long ways away from Leave It to Beaver, let's put it that way.
Betty knows who she is. Her family came over like 1640 or something. So she knows who she is. So they finished the examination, and Barney's in the other room. they had this little interlude where the guys who were examining Barney come in and start messing with her teeth, and she tries to find out the leader seemed to be the only one who could speak English. You know, what's going on? Well, they couldn't understand why Barney's teeth came out and hers didn't, which I thought was a great little side comment. Anyway, she asks him, well, we're in the understatement of the year, she says, I know you're not from around here. Where are you from? So the alien shows her what I can only describe as a three-dimensional, probably a hologram, a star map. A bunch of points of light, which are supposedly stars, joined by three different kinds of lines, heavy trade routes, light trade routes, and occasional expeditions, a dashed line for that latter one. And Betty's looking up at this thing. It's about 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet. And she says, well, where are you on the map? Wise guy alien says, this is all relived under hypnosis from Dr. Benjamin Simon, an outstanding psychiatrist who used medical hypnosis to help shell-shock war veterans, post-traumatic stress syndrome, if you will, from World War II. This is not parlor games hypnosis. This is relive, very deep hypnosis with all your feelings and thoughts as things go on. Anyway, wise guy alien says, do you know where you are on the map? No, I don't know anything about astronomy. Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. Now, you can imagine Dr. Simon is hearing this. Betty's a social worker, a supervisor in the welfare department at the state of New Hampshire. Barney works for the post office, but he's very active in civil rights activities. And these people are telling him a crazy story about a flying saucer that landed and took him on board and stuff. It's a long, involved story. And he, fortunately, he didn't know anything about UFOs, didn't care anything about UFOs. His job was to get through the missing 2 hours that they had suffered through. And the terror in their voices in some of these sessions were so strong that he had to stop the sessions. I mean, we're not talking about just a little upset kind of thing. Anyway, fortunately, Dr. Simon asks her to please draw it later on if she can remember it accurately. It's a post-hypnotic suggestion. She does, and it's in the book, The Interrupted Journey, but who knows what it means? Okay, so there's a dozen stars or so, and they're trade routes, but we don't have a reference point. I mean, the galaxy has something like 200 billion stars, and they're not all in this map, but even our local neighborhood's got a lot of stars that obviously can't be all in the map. And so it's published in the book, and then a brilliant woman named Marjorie Fish, member of Mensa, background in biology, teaching school, as a matter of fact, visited Betty and asked a lot of questions, went back and built three-dimensional models of our local neighborhood, beads strung on nylon fish line. Biggest one was like 3 foot cube with 250 some stars in it, beads in it. And the whole point of this exercise was to see if there was a three-dimensional pattern that could be observed that matched the two-dimensional one that Betty drew, you know, just a map on a piece of paper. And at first she had no success, and the hard part was the distance data. You see, astronomers weren't going anywhere. This is in the late 60s now, mind you, in the early 70s. And you can aim a telescope at a star. You don't need to know how far away it is, just two angles. And you're looking at the star, whether it's 20 or 40 light years, doesn't matter. But if you're building a three-dimensional model, you better have distances. And then a new catalog of the distances to nearby stars, a better catalog. We have much, much better ones now, and the work stands up very well. The Gliese catalog, Wilhelm Gliese. She rebuilt, Marjorie did, one of her models, and there was the pattern. A big, exciting day. Now, there were several special things about this pattern. One is all the stars connected with lines were sun-like stars, even though roughly 5% of the stars in the neighborhood are sun-like stars. And all the sun-like stars in this very well-defined three-dimensional volume of space, 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet, I forget how many light years, 20 or 30 light years on a side, something like that. All the sun-like stars in that volume of space are part of the pattern, and all the pattern stars are sun-like stars. Now, the chance of that being a coincidence, you know, you grab a dozen stars at random, oh, yeah, look at that, they're all the right kind and only the right kind. chance of that being a coincidence like 1 in 10,000. Some people say 1 in a million. I'm a very conservative guy, as you can tell, only 1 10,000. And all these stars, the pattern stars, are in a plane. Think of a big, big, thin pizza with very thin slices of pepperoni. They're all in a plane, as opposed to a big, fat loaf of raisin bread with raisins all over the place. And the importance of this is it makes travel between these stars much easier if you're all in the same plane. Our solar system, for example, all the planets in the solar system are in a plane. If you could run a big plate through the center of the sun, all the planets would be very close to being on that plate if you put it at the right angle. This makes travel a lot easier. Nobody knew this before Marjorie's work. And that's the work that told us about these base stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. Now, it was very controversial. I published the first article in 1972. I convinced Astronomy Magazine to do an article, 1975, I guess. Got more response than anything they'd ever published before or since. They put out a booklet, 32 full-color pages, and they sold 10,000 copies right off the bat. This never happened before. Now, what's interesting is, in the last 5 years or so, the European Space Agency has launched the Hipparcos satellite, and they've made literally millions of measurements of distance. They're much more accurate when you make them from off the Earth as opposed to on the Earth. And you know what? Now we know Zeta 1, Zeta 2 Reticuli are 39.2 light years instead of 37.4, which is what we thought at the time. But we also know that the separation is only an eighth of a light year. Couldn't get it very accurately back then because neither of the distances was very accurate. So it's a very exciting piece of work that has stood the test of time remarkably well. And, of course, it was attacked. Everybody who attacked it, including my college classmate Carl Sagan, misrepresented what Marjorie did and how she did it. This is typical of the debunkers of the UFO scene. There are a few of these. They're nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them. Four basic rules for debunkers. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Don't bother me with the facts. I was going to say I don't care about the facts. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. And do your research by proclamation. How often I have heard there is no evidence from people who don't bother to reference the large-scale scientific studies. It's as if they didn't exist. What they mean is, not that there isn't any evidence, I know these things can't be real. Therefore, I'm not going to look for any evidence. It would be a waste of my time because I'm sure there isn't any, because if there was, I would know about it. I'm so smart, and I don't, so there must not be. And anybody who says there is must be some kind of a nut. This crazy notion, and I keep hearing this all the time, since most sightings can be explained, all could be. Since most people aren't 7 feet tall, nobody is. Since most people don't have AIDS, nobody does. Since most chemicals don't cure disease, more likely to kill you than cure you, no chemicals cure disease. I mean, this is nonsensical, and maybe it's my nuclear background. You get accustomed to dealing with the cream of the crop, so to speak. One naturally occurring isotope, uranium-235, is readily fissionable. There are hundreds of other isotopes. None of them are. But one is. That's the one we use. Okay. That's the sensible thing. It would be like saying, well, Barry Bonds struck out yesterday. What do you mean he hits home runs? He strikes out more times than he hits home runs. So what? I mean, the basketball coach's got the good sense to say, hey, don't tell me about midgets. Tell me about the seven-footer. Sure, there are fewer seven-footers than midgets probably, but I don't care. What's relevant is the big guy. It's the same with UFOs. What's relevant are the unexplainable sightings in every large-scale scientific study. Finds lots of them. People don't believe that? Well, they should look at the congressional hearings of 1968. 12 scientists provided testimony, either written or oral, to a congressional hearing of the House Committee on Science and Astronautics. I was one of the 12, and I'm proud of the fact that I was the only one of the 12 without a PhD degree. and Carl Sagan was one of the contributors, and Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the Air Force scientific consultant on UFOs, was, and other people from Berkeley and Stanford and other outstanding places. The best paper, though, was by Dr. James E. McDonald, a professor of physics, Institute of Atmospheric Physics, and let's face it, most flying saucers are seen in the atmosphere. Jim's paper presented information on 41 separate cases, subdivided into six different categories, things like, well, responding really to the objections. How come they're never seen over big cities? He gives you half a dozen big city cases.
I'll tell you what.
Well, why aren't they ever seen by the guys who watch the skies? You know, the pilots, the meteorologists, the astronomers. He gives you a bunch by those people. How come there's always only one witness, and that witness a kook? We define kook, of course, as somebody who claims to witness a UFO. So here's an outstanding study by scientists only. It's available. It's even on the Internet, I'm told, the Congressional Hearing on UFOs, Symposium on UFOs, July 29th, my birthday again, 1968. So these are but two of many examples. And isn't it amazing that the noisy negativists never refer to these?
We've got to take a short break. And I want to hear more about our noisy negativists. I've met a few of them, so we'll be back with Stanton Friedman right after this. If you would like to ask Stanton Friedman a question, be sure and send it to comment@kaij.us. That's comment@kaij.us. We'll be having Stanton back on the program, and at that time, he'll answer your questions. We're back with Stanton Friedman as our guest, and obviously the subject is UFOs. I was talking a little bit about the negativists. I went to the Little Green Men Festival in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and there was a fellow there by the name of Joe Nickel who handed me a wooden nickel. And let me ask you a question. Is all the criticism that he rails out against UFOs, does this fellow have, I don't know, does he have any kind of scientific background at all?
Well, he's good at magic, and he has 3 degrees in English. Now, you can convolute that, magically transform those into training in science. I've had some run-ins with Joe. He follows my 4 rules for debunkers extremely well. Don't bother me with the facts my mind's made up, as a good example. Around the time of the 50th anniversary of Roswell, I was in Roswell with a television camera in my face. He was in Los Angeles with another television camera. We could hear each other, but we couldn't see each other. And he started right off by saying, well, he knows what happened at Roswell. Oh, well, yeah, that PR guy just made up the story and put it out, the press release, to get attention. I, frankly, when I got up off the floor after that bit of nonsense, I said, you don't even know his name, do you? No. I said, well, his name is Walter Haught. He was also a bombardier during World War II, more than 20 missions over Japan. He dropped the instrument package over one of the 2 nuclear weapons tests at Operation Crossroads in 1946. He was the public information officer, for the most elite military group in the entire world, the 509th, which dropped the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also those 2 tests in at Operation Crossroads. The notion that he would have made up a press release and put it out on his own without authorization from Colonel Blanchard, who led the group, is absurd. Incidentally, Blanchard went on to be a 4-star general and was vice chief of staff of the Air Force when he died of a massive heart attack at the Pentagon in 1966. So here we have Joe with an explanation, another good example of his real scientific investigation capability. It's more the sleight of hand of the magician, and he has been a magician, was his explanation for the Flatwoods, West Virginia monster story of September 12, 1952. He did visit Flatwoods, but he didn't go to the site. He didn't talk to the key witnesses who were still alive, mind you. Of course, I've been at the site and I've talked to the witnesses. This is where a bunch of kids and a few adults were going up a hill because a saucer had flown over the town, sort of semi-circled around, and seemed to land at the top of the hill. And the only clear spot around, I realized when I got up there, the kids were going up the hill to see what was going on, and this call it a monster, probably a mechanical device with my remote control or somebody inside, comes out from behind a big tree. It was about 12 feet tall, judging by the height of the branch, the lowest branch on the tree that it went under. Anyway, scared the heck out of the kids, and they go heading down the hill, and it emitted some kind of a gaseous, noxious vapor that made the kids sick. And there was a whole big investigation at the time, and Joe, his explanation was easy. This was all nonsense. What the kids saw and scared them was a six-foot owl. I don't know of anybody else who's ever seen a six-foot owl. And the local people who examined the kids that night and the next day said they were genuinely sick, and you could smell this noxious stuff on the ground. And there's a new book, Shoot Them Down, by Frank Ficino, Jr., who spent over a dozen years working on the Flatwoods case, and is presenting his new book in West Virginia on September 7th and 8th, Charleston, West Virginia, the West Virginia State College. Big event. I'll be there, too, incidentally. I mean, this is research? No, it's proclamation. It's nonsense. And there are actually, there's only a small group of very vocal, noisy negativists. Dr. Michael Shermer is like that. People may have seen me on Larry King with him on July 13th. And I got a ton of email after that appearance, and many people said, how come you didn't punch him out, Stan? Well, it's not my style, but he's a noisy negativist, not surprisingly. He's got a PhD, as Nickel does, but again, he's not a scientist. It's in the history of science. He publishes a magazine, Skeptic Magazine. He's the editor and publisher, and he'll sell you all kinds of skeptical material. Is there any indication he's ever done any research on flying saucers? Not the slightest. He attacks abduction cases, and he accepts the work of a Dr. Susan Clancy, who's been on television. She has a Harvard PhD, and she explains abductions. It was false memory syndrome. She wrote a book, Why People Come to Think They've Been Kidnapped by Aliens. She started with the assumption that they obviously were suffering from false memory syndrome, and this is a good subject to study that with because we know it couldn't have happened. And then she goes on to make mistake after mistake after mistake, and she gets on television and says it's all easily explained. And it's interesting that Dr. Shermer on Amazon.com is really impressed with her book. I wrote a review of her book that gives facts, data, solid information, pointing out error after error after error. That's at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, a review of the Clancy abduction book. And so, you know, you get a little sick and tired of the noisy negativists making proclamations, not doing investigation, not referencing the data. Remember, what the public doesn't know, we're not going to tell them. 13 anti-UFO books that don't mention Blue Book Special Report 14, the largest study ever done. That may have gone up in the last couple of years. I don't know. I try to keep up, but it's tough reading the stuff. When it makes you angry when you see people misrepresent the facts. Now, the same thing goes, incidentally, for the Operation Majestic 12 documents. I consider that a few of these are the most important leaked, classified government documents ever leaked. They say that Truman set up a group called Majestic 12 in 1947 in response to Roswell, named the 12 members of the group outstanding group. And the question is whether the documents, which came in the form of a roll of film, the initial one, some others were found at the National Archives, whether they're genuine or not. Well, they can go to my book, Top Secret Magic, second edition, and I deal with all the arguments that have been made against these documents. Now, and I point out that a number of phony documents were released later. It's a standard technique for intelligence agencies. If good stuff gets out, load the market with garbage, and hopefully it will rub off on the good stuff, and we can forget the good stuff because everybody will think, well, this one's phony, so that one must be. And to listen, I mean, Joe Nickel again, oh, those documents are obvious frauds. The date format violates the government style manual. You think about that for a minute. This is 1952.
For those listening that don't know, anything at all about the Majestic 12, why don't you just brief these folks on this so they understand what it is that you're talking about here?
Okay. In 1984, two colleagues of mine got a roll of film in the mail in which there were two sets of eight negatives each, a briefing for President-elect Eisenhower. He'd been elected early November 52 and would take office in January of 53, and he was being briefed on all kinds of new stuff. I mean, remember, he'd been in Europe heading up our military effort there after the war, and now he's got to be briefed on what his problems he's going to face as president, a Cold War and all that kind of stuff. And so this briefing was ostensibly given to him on 18 November, 1952. And it says in this briefing, we only have one of the A through H attachments, and the one we have is a memo from President Truman, 1947, to Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, authorizing the establishment of Operation Majestic 12. And then it talks about there was a crash at Roswell, and bodies were recovered. This group is accountable only to the President of the United States. Pretty powerful stuff. And the question is whether the document's genuine. And one of the things that put all of us off was the fact that one of the members of the 12, there were two Army, two Navy, two Air Force, five scientists, and the Secretary of the Defense. One of the scientists was supposedly Dr. Donald Menzel, a Harvard University professor of astronomy, who had written three anti-UFO books. Now, when we got the roll of film, it was 2 months after the last survivor had died. Coincidence, you might say, how handy that we can't ask anybody anything. Anyway, the problem was Dr. Menzel. He was a total debunker. How could he be part of a group that, A, had all had high-level security clearances? You don't need one of those to teach astronomy at Harvard. And how could he be a debunker and yet know all about crash saucers, alien bodies, etc.? Well, I was very dubious. I didn't like the man while he was alive. But I had to get permission from three different people to look at his papers at Harvard and discovered to my total shock that he led a double life. He told Jack Kennedy that he had a longer lifetime of activity with the National Security Agency, NSA, no such agency, or never says anything, those guys, of anybody in the country, 30 years as of 1960, with its Navy predecessor. He did classified work for 30 different companies. He had a top-secret ultra clearance with the CIA. None of this was known. And you won't find it in an eight-page appreciation after he died. This is in Astronomy Sky and Telescope magazine. So once I dug out the goodie on Dr. Menzel, like I say, a total shock. I then proceeded more. And after umpteen more years, I finally wrote my book, Top Secret Magic. But in the second edition, which came out in 2005, I deal with all the objections raised by the noisy negativists. And one of them was by Joe Nickel about the date format, 18 November, comma, 1952. Not supposed to have that comma there. Therefore, the document is fraudulent. Well, when you go to the archives, and I've been to 20 of them, you find for that time frame, this is before computers now, before people were using computers for word processing and all that sort of thing, you find all kinds of date formats. I had one file folder that had seven date formats. I found the same date format, day, month, comma, year, used by two of the members of MJ-12, two former directors of Central Intelligence, I might add. No surprise that they're on the group. So I go down all the arguments, and as a matter of fact, I even made $1,000 from another one of the noisy negativists, the late Philip Klass. He worked for Aviation Week in Space Technology, wrote several anti-UFO books, knew all about Blue Book Special Report 14, never mentioned it in his books. He challenged me on one of the documents, one of the MJ-12, Majestic 12, Magic 12 documents. The typeface was wrong. It's the large pica. Perhaps I didn't notice it. But the White House used only the small elite type, and he had nine documents to prove it. He got them by mail from the Eisenhower Library. Of course, he'd never been there, and of course, I've spent weeks there. So he challenged me to find any other genuine documents done in the same size and style, pica type, and he offered me $100 each up to a maximum of 10 for any such genuine documents. He had a whole bunch of criteria they had to meet. I sent him 20 done in pica type. I knew we would only accept a couple because they weren't all signed or whatever it was, but I was going to the Eisner Library. Anyway, make a long story short, I found 14, copied them, sent him a copy and an invoice for $1,000, and he paid me. He told everybody about challenging me, nobody about paying me. Here's the kicker, though. How could anybody in his right mind go from 9 documents to the 250,000 National Security Council documents that were at the Eisenhower Library? That's one heck of a generalization. I mean, if you had 99 out of 100 and you're missing one, and they were all done on the same typewriter, now it's not too unreasonable, the 100th one is. But from 9 to 250,000? That's typical of the intellectual bankruptcy of the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. So the book is Top Secret / Magic, M-A-J-I-C. There's a paper on my website that sort of updates an update on the Majestic 12, in which, again, I review attacks on the documents. But, you know, I don't mind debating people. I debated at Oxford University. I'm debating with Dr. Michael Shermer, the head of the Skeptic Society, on Coast to Coast Radio. But I wish they had some facts and some data and had done some homework. We won the one at Oxford, incidentally. They took a vote of the people who attended. But, you know...
We are up to the break. Let's take this break very quickly as we can. And we'll be back with Stanton Friedman right after this. If you would like to ask Stanton Friedman a question, be sure and send it to comment@kaij.us. That's comment@kaij.us. We'll be having Stanton back on the program, and at that time, he'll answer your questions. Our guest is Stanton Friedman. We are back. And I wanted to ask you a question. You talked about Majestic 12, but what was the purpose of that group? What were they to do? Or what was that all about?
Majestic 12 was set up to do an intelligence and technological evaluation of the whole saucer scene. In other words, they said we had a crash saucer. Somebody has got to coordinate sending out pieces, trying to figure out how the darn thing works, collecting other data that might help you in that pursuit. And there are two different parts to that now. You got wreckage, so you got lab testing to try to figure out, you know, what's this made out of? What does this do? But you also need to collect reports from observers, airplanes chasing UFOs, taking gun camera pictures. How does the color around the saucer change as it changes direction or velocity? Does it put out any kind of an electromagnetic signal? All this kind of stuff. And if you think of the Western wagon wheel without a rim, everything comes in down the spokes of the wheel, so to speak, but nothing goes out and around. So you need a coordinating group with the highest level clearances, and all these people had them, and status, I mean, generals, admirals, that sort of thing, and scientists who had worked during the war, so they were known quantities and all that. Truman, and I found somebody who worked for President Truman all the time he was in the White House, and I asked him, do you have any reason to think that if such a thing as a crashed saucer event had happened, that Truman would not have named any of these people? Maybe he didn't like this one, or he didn't trust this one, or that. See, I couldn't ask him if the documents were genuine, because if he knew, he couldn't tell me. What I had to do was ask this guy questions that he could answer, and one of them was, you see anything about the documents that would lead you to believe they were fraudulent? The answer was no. Do you see any good reason why Truman would not have named this or that person? And the answer was no, and he knew who all the people were. So their job was to collect, review, evaluate. I doubt if they had weekly meetings or anything like that. They were people with clout. But after the war, I guess a lot of people aren't old enough to recall this, but we had what are called dollar-a-year men. People who worked for the government during the war, who continued to make a contribution, even if they were civilians, they would serve on committees in Washington. No sense wasting their valuable backgrounds. So Truman knew where to find these people. He probably would have asked General George C. Marshall, who was the chief of staff really all during World War II, and whom Truman considered the outstanding living American, and who was Secretary of State in 1947 and Secretary of Defense in 1950. He was older than the members of this group, incidentally. So their group was a shadow group, if you will. Call it a shadow cabinet, like. But they were accountable only to the president, no middlemen. And the documents are top secret ultra, or umbra, as the case may be, or in the case of these documents, top secret magic. The point is that that's a level above. You need a further caveat, a further need to know, not just confidential, secret, top secret, but top secret magic, a limited number of people cleared for magic documents. A very exciting document, and I was surprised to come out thinking that they're genuine, as I describe in the book, because I've been there. I've worked under security. I've been to the archives, and I know how easy it is to cover things up.
When you were talking earlier about, you know, not being able to keep a secret, and of course we know different because there's so many things that are still under wraps, and, you know, it's like them releasing the missing minutes on the Nixon tape. You know, I mean, nobody knew anything about that until it was released, you know. But let me ask you this question. I'm going to move away from this just for a minute because I know this is probably on the minds of a lot of listeners. In all the research you've done, is there any indication that you can tell as to who is it? This is a two-part question. Who is it that usually winds up getting abducted in these abduction stories? And in the research you've done, has there been any other contact, or is there any other methods that have been used that's been successful at contacting UFOs? I mean, I've heard stories of lights flashing and these kind of things. And, you know, I'm familiar with SETI. And, of course, they're sitting there listening and listening and listening and listening. And
expecting the aliens to use the same communication techniques we use, which is rather a large assumption.
But of those two questions, you know, is there any pattern as to who gets abducted and...
Well, not really. One of the fascinating thing about abductions, and I've talked to Bud Hopkins, who's written three excellent books on the subject, and Dr. David Jacobs and Dr. John Mack, and Bud has got people who were detectives, who were PhDs, who were psychiatrists, who were military people. There's a whole slew of them. Now, I asked one abductee who claimed to have had a conversation with somebody about the whole situation, and I said, did they give you a clue as to why you? And she said, they said something about it was easier to detect. Now, you think about that for a minute. I'm sure the first guy who measured brain waves must have been laughed out of town. What do you mean, electromagnetic signals from the brain? Can't you see that there's no device in there? Well, now we know that the brain mind, if you will, does put out electromagnetic signals. So it may be they're tuned in and it's easier to follow some people than others. One of the things that came clear to me when I was at the exact location where Betty and Barney Hill were abducted up in New Hampshire, out in the boonies, was that clearly Barney wouldn't have made the two turns he had to make to get to that location off a tertiary road, not even a secondary road, is that the aliens were controlling what he did mentally. And it comes through in all the abductions that we would stick a knife in somebody's back or a gun at their head, you do what you're told or else. These guys seem to be able to do it by mental control. And so the notion of picking up on people on the basis of their brainwaves, if you will, doesn't sound too far out. And incidentally, don't you think every government would love to be able to control people's behavior mentally? I mean, get the whole army to drop their arms, you know.
or around tax time.
Yeah, the second question was, what? I just lost it.
Okay, you have SETI sitting there listening.
Oh, yeah.
Big dishes and receivers, but yet you have people say, we've hailed UFOs by flashing lights in the sky. Is there any truth to that, what do you think about that?
There have been a number of cases where people turned the headlights on and off and were shocked when the saucer turned its lights on and off. I think they're playing games. I think that they're checking reactions. One of the things that comes through in the Betty and Barney Hill case is the curiosity of the beings. Remember, these were lots of sessions with Dr. Simon as they each relive what happened to them on board the craft. And you get a much more insight in that one case than in all the other cases I'm aware of the behavior patterns of the aliens. And one of them is certainly that they're curious, this business with Barney's teeth. And then Betty said, well, his teeth came out for nutrition. He had an accident. People get older, they lose their teeth. And them asking questions and, you know, curiosity. Also, one of the interesting things is they come at Betty with a big needle. She's on a table. They tell her they're going to do a pregnancy test. And the doctor has this huge needle and comes at her. And it's going to hurt. She's screaming. And it won't hurt. And it does. And he waves his hand to stop the pain. She was very grateful for that. So, again, mental control, I would say. He didn't touch her. And so their willingness to try to avoid intentionally doing pain. A lot of people pick up specimens. Do you really care whether the polar bear is hurt or not when you knock him out with those needles, you know? And so there are a lot of this kind of thing of it's communication in a limited way. If we had 10 departments of alien abduction studies, we could explore these matters far more. But as you know, if it's considered out in left field, if you claim to have seen a UFO, how much worse for an abduction? I mean, I check all my lecture audiences, more than 700 so far. Good sampling, in other words. At the end of my lecture, I'll ask, how many people here believe they've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? And I've given my definitions early on. And I make a joke, you know, the CIA wasn't allowed in. It's okay. And hands go up slowly. Just raise your hand. And they know I'm not going to laugh. My lectures, flying saucers, are real, underline and capitalize the R. And I start counting and pointing. One, two, three, four. By the time I get to the other side of the room, the hands go up much more readily. It's 10% of the audience, which is a lot of people. Each one had thought he was the only one, or she. Then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down. Biggest reason given me after the lecture, you know, why didn't you report it? They think I was some kind of a nut. Well, if there are any hands left, I'll say, how many of you were in the military? Still some hands left. I'll say, you want to tell us about it? I get some very interesting lines. Like one guy in front of 1,300 people in Texas said, I can't. They told me not to say anything, which was a wonderful line. I get one guy who says, they took my pictures. He doesn't say anything more. So I say, look, I'm sure everybody would like to hear the rest of the story. You don't need to give your name. You don't need to stand up, et cetera. Everybody claps. So he tells his story. He's flying an Air Force plane, four-engine plane, out over the Pacific, another plane ahead of them 20 miles, radios back, saucer heading your way. They had gun cameras. They took pictures, and they reported to the base. They radioed the base they were going to because the film gets handled by other people, not by crew members. They land, the film gets taken, they get debriefed and told not to say anything. Now, two other cases like this that deal directly with your question, two different times, completely independently, because I don't use this stuff in my lectures. A guy tells me he's at a classified facility, they pick up something on radar, they pick up a signal from it, the tapes are going around. They're picking up a signal from this thing, and the security guys come in and take the tapes, and you didn't see anything, you didn't hear anything. All these people have clearances, mind you. They wouldn't have been in the room. Twice I've heard that. So maybe what we should be doing is try to figure out how they're communicating to each other when they're running around the planet. Mothership to Earth excursion module, come in, please. Except what technique are they using?
You know, it's like you can, you know, you look at these aerial shots or, you know, from space, all the lights on the planet, you know, you see these lights in all these cities. So you think to yourself, you know, one little light going on and off pointed up in the sky is probably going to be totally lost unless they're a lot lower than the vantage point from which the picture was taken.
Oh, yeah. Well, the pictures are taken from up in space. There's gun camera pictures of UFOs. There are pictures taken by spy satellites. Now, what people tend to forget is that the best systems for monitoring what's happening in the atmosphere of the planet are all give data that's born classified. You know, they talk about reading the license plates in the Kremlin parking lot. Great cameras to do that. But that data isn't released every day. You know, the newspapers also don't tell you how often jets were scrambled after, I love the phrase, uncorrelated targets. Not UFOs, uncorrelated targets. As a matter of fact, in 1952, and it's in this book, Shoot Them Down, orders were issued to military pilots, if the UFOs don't land when instructed to do so, shoot them down. And the head of the American Rocket Society actually wrote a letter to President Truman saying they didn't think that was a good idea. And we have an Air Force general, actually it's in the Louisville Courier in 1952, quoted as saying that we've scrambled jets hundreds of times after them, unsuccessfully. Now, incidentally, I have heard seven instances of more planes going up than came back down after UFOs. I think we tried to shoot them down, and they responded in kind. I'd sure like to hear from anybody else who knows about that, obviously not from somebody who has disappeared. The New York Times had 200 accounts between 1950 and 55 of airplanes crashing.
We are out of time, and this could go on for another 2 hours or more.
Not tonight.
But I want to thank you so much for coming on board, and you're going to have to come back.
So, will do.
And in the meantime, maybe folks can send us some questions, and that'll be good. www.stantonfriedman.com. That's the website, and we thank you so much, sir. It's been
my
great.
Pleasure.